You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Alex Dieterer. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, March 15th, 2021.
There's a very limited amount of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to date that's been received locally.
Later in the program, we have the latest edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor, our weekly segment where we ask Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton listener-posed questions on community issues. More coming up in today's feature report.
Morgan County has, according to the CDC, has the highest rates of cancer in our state.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced a cleanup plan for the Martinsville Superfund site at Pike and Mulberry Streets. More in today's headlines. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Monday, March 15th. I'm Aaron Comforti. Indiana University basketball coach Archie Miller has made the news twice in the past week. The first time was when IU football coach Tom Allen got a raise to an almost $5 million yearly salary, surpassing Archie Miller's $3.5 million a year. Archie Miller again made the news this morning after Indiana University fired him. His firing comes after a disappointing season's finish. Miller was the top-paid employee at the university. Last week, the city of Bloomington announced that it would provide $12,000 one-time mortgage down payments and a vehicle ownership and rental subsidy for Bloomington police officers. Chief Dekoff described the measure as a way to, quote, attract and retain the best possible candidates. Critics of the program have voiced disappointment, noting that the city consistently allocates funds to the police department, seemingly over other issues like homelessness and social services. In state news, Indiana teachers are now eligible to get the COVID-19 vaccine. After months of lobbying by State House Democrats and state teachers' unions, it was only after Biden's presidential directive on vaccinating teachers that Indiana assented. Starting today, teachers and staff in pre-K through high school, at child care centers, and in Head Start and Early Start programs can schedule vaccine appointments, while college-level instructors are not yet eligible. Licensed child care providers, classroom aides, bus drivers, janitors, counselors, administration staff, cafeteria workers, and substitute teachers may all make vaccination appointments as well. And that's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill announced that any child care and education workers can receive a COVID-19 vaccination at any clinic during their March 12th COVID-19 press conference. She reminded the community of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's definition of fully vaccinated individuals.
Fully vaccinated means that if you took Pfizer or Moderna, which is a two-dose vaccine, it is 2 weeks following your second dose. And if you're getting Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that's a one-dose vaccine, and it's 2 weeks following that.
Caudill mentioned CDC guidance for fully vaccinated people concerns only small gatherings. She stated vaccinated individuals in public spaces must still maintain a 6-foot distance and wear a mask.
If you are fully vaccinated, you can visit other vaccinated people indoors without masks or physical distancing. You can visit indoors with unvaccinated people from a single household without masks or physical distancing, if the unvaccinated person is at low risk for severe disease.
Caudill stated vaccinated individuals would have to quarantine if determined they've had a close contact, but should still monitor for symptoms. Indiana University Health South Central Region Brian Shockney said IU Health has given about 20% of Indiana vaccinations.
As of March 11th, the IU Health South Central region has administered 47,335 COVID-19 vaccines at our Bloomington and Paoli clinics. Our Bloomington clinic has given 35,867 of the 37,480 we've received, which is a 95.7% rate of giving the vaccine as we receive it. Overall, IU Health has provided 230,000 plus vaccine at all of our vaccine sites across the state. And as Penny mentioned, with over just 1.1 million total vaccine given in the state, IU Health still accounts for about 20% of all vaccines given in the state of Indiana.
Caudill mentioned Monroe County saw a moderate increase of COVID-19 community spread. IU Vice President for Engagement, Kirk White, stated the IU Vaccination Clinic will open on March 29th.
The Monroe County Board of Health debated COVID-19 regulations concerning guests at communal living facilities. Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill stated the current regulation.
The board will continue to prohibit non-essential guests, including members of the facility's organization who are not currently slated to live in the facility. Essential guests are those who are providing a professional service to the facility. Guest logs shall be maintained. Each facility shall adhere to the gathering sizes and all the board's regulations. Virtual gatherings are highly encouraged and recommended.
House Director Bill Kirshner requested the board allow 15 guests outside of the communal living building. Board Member Ashley Craner stated she would not want to see more than 15 people outdoors together, including House residents. Board Member Carol Litton-Tulacane expressed her support for the change.
That was part of the fun of spring on IU's campus. I mean, we really enjoyed those sort of things. And I think that there's some significant mental health issues that have been going on with all the stress with this year, and it's a very small thing we can do that might, you know, as Dr. Wren said, you know, something to look forward to that you could actually do that you haven't been able to do. And again, if you want to limit it to 5 instead of 15, whatever. But it doesn't require change. It really doesn't, unless you want to add that, it doesn't require change in regulation. It just means defining the facility as the actual building, not the lawn. You don't actually have to change anything to do that.
Board members approved to delegate the decision regarding outside guests to Caudill and Monroe County Health Officer Dr. Thomas Sharp in collaboration with Indiana University officials.
A Senate bill in Indiana aims to bring music production to the state. Senate Bill 323 is a music production incentive program. It would work with the Indiana Destination Development Corporation to provide a report on music production incentives in other states and to make a recommendation on the type of incentive Indiana should offer. Last month, the bill passed out of the state Senate. Now the bill has been referred to the Indiana House Ways and Means Committee. If the bill passes the House, Indiana would join the ranks of 32 other states in having a music production incentive program, according to the State House file. As of now, Indiana has an $8 billion music industry with around 50,000 jobs. State Senator Justin Bush, a Republican from Fort Wayne, helped author the bill. He said, quote, "If we're going to play in the music industry, this is a program we need to have. Otherwise, we're really getting overlooked when we have a hidden, robust music ecosystem in our state," end quote. Bloomington sports a thriving music industry with independent record labels like the Secretly Group, concert venues such as the Bluebird and the IU Jacobs School of Music, which ranks second in the nation according to the QS World University Ratings. The music industry was hit hard in 2020. However, Goldman Sachs projected the music industry's revenue to increase from $62 billion in 2017 to $131 billion by 2030. Bush says he hopes the bill will enhance Indiana's music industry. He said in the State House file, quote, "We all appreciate music. Even when we had a downturn last year, we all kind of turned to music. It's a universal language," end quote.
On Friday, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced an $11.9 million cleanup plan for the Pike and Mulberry Streets Superfund site in Martinsville. According to a news release, the EPA's cleanup plan will address soil and groundwater contamination caused by industrial and dry cleaning chemicals, which were, quote, illegally dumped and mishandled in the late 1980s, end quote. The cleanup plan will tackle contamination of tetrachloroethylene, or PCE, in the groundwater. It will also address trichloroethylene, or TCE, gases in the soil. The EPA says it preferred to use a chemical oxidation method, an environmental remediation technique, to reduce contaminants. On May 24, 2018, during the Daily Local News, former news director Wes Martin asked Dr. Diane Henschel, an environmental toxicology expert, what PCE can do to the human body.
So what does it do? So it does depend, and the data that we have comes from both air and drinking water exposure, so please realize that. And there's two kinds of exposure. There's the short-term exposure, and then there's the longer-term exposure. And they're going to have different effects. So, for example, a more typical short-term exposure is going to be related to the nervous system. So some people get headaches or queasy from it. You can get disorientation or dizziness from it. You could be irritable from it. If you have a longer-term but not very long-term exposure, especially through the air, you couldn't, or even potentially in drinking water, but most often through the air for this, could be seeing memory deficits or concentration problems. It could be affecting your sleep. It could affect your ability to walk a little bit. It can give you what's called ataxia, so your movements aren't quite as smooth. You could have delayed reaction times. And for longer term exposure, you could end up with some peripheral neuropathy. Your nerves could actually start being damaged, directly damaged by it. For longer-term exposure, we're talking about effects on a whole variety of different organs. So liver, because liver does the processing of it. Kidney, which is where a lot of it is removed. It affects the cardiovascular system and causes like heart arrhythmia. That could be a short-term or a longer-term effect. Can cause pulmonary edema, that's at least not very short term. And it can have reproductive effects as well as causing cancer.
Hoosier Action, a local nonpartisan advocacy group, hosted a town hall on the Superfund site in October 2020. Town hall moderator Tasha Coppinger discussed the health impacts of contaminated sites in Morgan County.
Morgan County has, according to the CDC, has the highest rates of cancer in our state. There are four contaminated sites that we know of in Martinsville alone that are beneath people's homes. These contaminants have PCE and TCE, which are chemicals that are known to cause kidney cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, cardiac effects, and bladder cancer. And there's evidence linking them to leukemia, liver cancer, multiple myeloma, rectal cancer, impaired immune system functions, various neurological and neurobehavioral effects, and severe generalized hypersensitivity skin disorder, as well as kind of being suspected of causing multiple other effects.
The EPA will hold a virtual public forum on Zoom to learn more about the cleanup and to develop community-based recommendations. You can register by visiting WFHB.org following this newscast.
The Monroe County Stormwater Management Board considered a memorandum of understanding for $1,000 with the Lake Monroe Waterfront Task Force during their March 10th meeting. MS4 coordinator Kelsey Thetonia stated the donation would initiate an education and outreach program.
I required in the MOU a education outreach plan so that they outline exactly what they will be using the funds for to make sure it aligns with our stormwater program's, priorities. We already have our stormwater quality management plan for the MS4 program that has an education outreach component. So, we'd like to see what they plan to use the funding for to make sure it is an appropriate use of our stormwater funds.
Thetonia stated the funds would be available until the end of 2021. Board Member Penny Githens questioned Task Force Member Jane Martin what the education was for.
Is education here about raising funds, or what exactly is education going to cover, I guess?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
Yes. We have gotten conditional approval from the City of Bloomington Utilities to include an insert on why a water fund is important, what is a water fund, driving people to our website, and providing boxes, and essentially making the case. So that will be part of the education program. That will start May 1st. Vic Kelson has asked us to delay it a month. So the month of April, our website will go live. We will begin a partnering strategy with corporate customers and institutions and a media campaign. And this will be ongoing really for the remainder of this year.
Martin stated, Lake Monroe was built to last 100 years and needs preservation work. She mentioned the education would inform people on the importance of contributing to their water fund. Board members unanimously approved the MOU.
The Bloomington Board of Historic Preservation discussed the restoration of a commercial storefront damaged by an automobile accident during their March 11th meeting. The building is located at 118 South College Avenue. Historic Preservation Manager Connor Herderick spoke about the reconstruction.
The petitioner is requesting to replace this original bronze metal storefront framing with a bronze rub anodized aluminum product. They'll be keeping the header here or the cap, but they will be replacing the vertical pieces and the lower sill portion with this anodized aluminum product. And they will be installing, I believe, quarter inch thick tempered glass. They will also be replacing this broken piece of limestone here. And then they will be removing an unoriginal door that was added. You can see it better in this photograph. Here you can see a door. They're going to be removing this unoriginal door and restoring it back to the 120 South College storefront, which is what this one looked like. So they're going to mirror the plate glass dimensions from the 120 College storefront to the new one that they're going to be restoring.
Herderick stated the original bronze was too difficult to source and replace. Board members unanimously approved the restorations.
Now it's time for A Few Minutes with the Mayor, a weekly segment where we ask Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton listener-posed questions on community issues.
Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions.
Well, the first question that I have today is, the city has a $100 wellness program for city employees who get their vaccination. Where is this money sourced from?
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, I'm really glad we're able to do this. It's basically part of our wellness program that we do with our third-party administrator, part of our healthcare system. So it's built into the healthcare budget, and we've worked with them to make sure we can manage it. And like we give employees rebates or cash in their paychecks for gym membership, for certain kind of massages, for anti-smoking programs and stuff, we're doing a similar thing for the vaccine because it's really important to protect the health of our workforce, that people who qualify do get vaccinated against COVID-19. And it also helps other workers more than some of those things. It helps other workers and helps our community. So it's basically part of the healthcare budget, which we've been able to manage very well over the last few years in combination with our providers. And I'm very much hopeful that a large number of our employees will take advantage of this $100 paycheck supplement when they show they've gotten the vaccine.
So the next question is, are any of the local COVID-19 vaccination clinics offering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
There's a very limited amount of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to date that's been received locally, and it's really being reserved so far. All this driven by the health department and state health, being reserved so far for essentially homebound or people for whom getting to a vaccine location is difficult, because obviously that one-shot regime is easier than a two-shot regime. So right now there's very limited access to the Johnson & Johnson. I do think that could change in the future. We don't know for sure, but if there are indications that we may get substantially more Johnson & Johnson vaccine, we'll certainly make it available through the health system. Now, that all being said, I do think the best advice that everybody says, public health experts nationally and locally, is whenever you get a chance to get a vaccine, just get it, no matter which one it is. And I'll be going on Wednesday this week to get my vaccine, and I don't even know which one it is. It's either Pfizer or Moderna, and I'll take either one.
Could you talk about those like kind of hotspot clinics that are popping up for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and where maybe someone could find out how to register for one of those? I know they're quickly being filled up, but if they're still happening.
Well, there are different things going on. The hotspot, these big clinics that the state is running like they did at the Indianapolis Speedway a couple weekends ago, and I think there was some far north and far south of the state last weekend. Those are run by the state health department. They do use Johnson & Johnson vaccine as part of the allocation that the state is getting. And the best way to look for those is either on the state coronavirus website, or you can call 211 and ask about that. Locally, all we're doing so far with the Johnson & Johnson is the kind of the homebound special outreach to high-risk people and populations that have difficulty connecting with a site. But the big sites, like I think up at the Indy Speedway, they did, I think I saw 14,000 or many thousands over a weekend. That is done through the state system, and just go into the state website and check it out or call 211.
Our last question today, it comes from Sarah, and she is wondering, what alternatives are you proposing since the ordinance change for protections for people experiencing homelessness failed in the city council session?
Well, there's a ton going on in our community to help people both avoid homelessness as well as get out of homelessness and back into a home as quickly as possible. There are major grant programs that are underway. There's daily coordination among providers who are running day shelters as well as city, county, nonprofit folks coordinating how to deal with that. There's a longer-term regional effort led by the Community Foundation and the United Way to explore housing insecurity and what we can do about that. So I don't think the defeat of that proposed ordinance should be viewed as anything other than it was an idea that was not agreed to by the council, but there's an extraordinary number of people working very hard to try to help folks get out of homelessness. And I always try to remind people that the vast majority of people in our community who experience homelessness experience it briefly and are helped in and out of it as quickly as possible, whether it's a family or an individual. And that's the goal, is to make homelessness rare, make it brief, and make it non-repeating. And that's what we're working on. The whole community is really working on that very strongly.
Do you see any short-term alternatives to the ordinance which more directly resemble the ordinance, such as a different working or different way of providing a sort of encampment space as an option?
Well, the ordinance, which suggested allowing or designating camping sites in city parks or similar location, did not pass. I think primarily because most of the council did not think sleeping outdoors in formal encampments is a good and safe approach for homeless people, homeless families, homeless people experiencing homelessness. So I think what's happening instead is we've had a major expansion of the emergency shelter beds. Over 200 people are accessing emergency overnight shelter indoors in weather they're protected with hygiene and bathrooms and such. And I think there's some discussion of how to extend that. I think, virtually nobody thinks that emergency shelter, whether it's an encampment or an indoor facility, that that's the long-term and best result for people experiencing homelessness. So as I said, it's really trying to look at how do we follow that housing first model to get people who are experiencing homelessness, whether it's an individual or a family, as quickly as possible into safe shelters. And that's what the focus is on.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sydney Foreman.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Alex Dieterer.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
The WFHB Local News is available as a podcast. Just search our call letters WFHB wherever you find your podcasts. Subscribe and never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for With Good Reason, coming up next on WFHB Community Radio.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,